Matthew chapter 5, the Sermon on the Mountain. In Matthew 5, we have seen the characteristics of a godly person, we've seen the influence of a godly person, and now we see that a godly person's righteousness surpasses that of the Pharisees. We're in that section, Matthew 5, 21 through 48. Last week we talked about murder and being angry. I guess that was actually probably 2 weeks ago. I forget now. Then I know last week we talked about committing adultery and lusting. And we also talked about divorce and the exception of unchastity. Then in verse 33, Jesus says, "Again, you have heard that the ancients were told, 'You shall not make false vows, but fulfill your vows to the Lord.' But I say to you," remember, we're going through this and we're contrasting, or the Lord is contrasting what they have heard or they have said with the higher, more accurate interpretation of what they were getting at to begin with, okay? And we have said that they may be quoting from Scripture, but the way he introduces, "You have heard that it was said," seems like he is quoting their paraphrase of Scripture, if you will. For example, here in verse 33, "You have heard that the ancients were told, 'You shall not make false vows, but fulfill your vows to the Lord.'" There's actually no direct correlation to that in the Old Testament, or I should say, this is not a quote from the Old Testament, okay? There are others. It seems to be a compilation of several different passages put together. So, "You have heard the ancients were told, 'You shall not make false vows, but shall fulfill your vows to the Lord.' But I say to you, make no oath at all, either by heaven, for it is the throne of God, or by the earth, for it is the footstool of his feet." And he goes on. They were not making, they were not making false vows, but fulfilling your vows to the Lord, okay? The Pharisees, what they would do is they would make false vows, depending on what little key word or how they turned the phrase. The illustration or the parallel might be they would stick their crossed fingers behind their back when they said something. They might swear by heaven. They might swear by the earth or Jerusalem. One man said, Rabbi Judah said, that he that saith by Jerusalem says nothing unless with an intent purpose that he shall vow towards Jerusalem. So you could throw that in here also. This man says, oh no, if you say Jerusalem, that doesn't mean anything. You've got to be looking at Jerusalem in that direction, and that way your vow is worth something. And Jesus is trying to counter such abuses as this. So he gives them several reasons. "You shall make no oath at all, either by heaven, for it is the throne of God, by earth, it is the footstool of his feet, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king." In other words, these are God's, they're not yours. If I might use an analogy, if I give an oath on John's John Deere tractor, what good is that? I can't do anything with John's tractor. We can't do anything with the earth, the heaven, or anything. It's God's. We can't do anything. Verse 36, "Nor shall you make an oath by your head, for you cannot make one hair white or black." You have no power at all. So the alternative is, but let your statement be yes, yes, or no, no. Anything beyond these is of evil. All right. Understand this. This is not an absolute prohibition against making oaths. Jesus himself, several years after he says this, will say something under oath. Turn to Matthew 26. Remember, in his trial, he's not saying anything. He's not saying anything. And, of course, they're getting frustrated. Matthew 26, 63, Jesus kept silent. The high priest said to him, "I," and my version says, "adjure you by the living God that you tell us whether or not you are the Christ, the Son of God." There's a footnote there in verse 63. That word adjure, also, basically the essence of it is, "I charge you under oath," is what my version says. He's calling God as his witness. Are you the Son of God? And Jesus goes on and responds, "You have said it yourselves, nevertheless I tell you that I am the Son of God." Paul also, turn to 2 Corinthians chapter 1. 2 Corinthians chapter 1, Paul is defending that, yes, he actually is an apostle. And in the midst of that, verse 23, he says, I call God as my witness to my soul, that to spare you I did not come again to Corinth, so on and so forth. Okay? Here he's saying, look, I call God as my witness. If Paul did and Jesus did, then we can. Okay? God himself takes oaths. Later in the book of Revelation, we see angels taking oaths. Okay? It is not saying that oaths are a sin. The point is, they would say, hey, look, I didn't take an oath, so I get to say whatever I want. And Jesus is saying, that's not true. It doesn't matter if you've taken an oath or not. You have to tell the truth all the time. I hope that's made some sense. The evil is not the oath, but the deception behind it. Having said that, let me suggest that this is saying, don't play games. Don't try to stretch the truth so far until it breaks. Let me illustrate it this way. Last week, somebody was very generous and gave me a watermelon. Now, they didn't know it, but they put a stumbling block in front of me when they did that, because I like watermelon a lot. So we get home, and Marcy asks me, hey, do we have a watermelon? And I said, no. And then she said, isn't there a watermelon in the car? And I said, no, again. Later on, I brought in a watermelon. Well, she asked, how can you say that's not in the car? Two counts. First of all, it's not a car. It's a van. Number two, we have another car that sits on our property that is not our car. It's my mom and dad's car. And when she asked, is it in a car or the car, I took the and referred it in my mind to my mom and dad's car. Now, technically, everything I did was true. But is that really the truth? Not at all. You can see where I was playing around. We have a lawyer back here. He could play games with us all day long. But we're not supposed to snap, stretch the truth until it snaps. So don't play games. Now, that's hard to do, especially if you like words to play around with. Now, I was joking with Marcy, because later on I brought out the watermelon. Here it is, and she even got to have a little bit of it. But sometimes we take these things too far and are serious with them. Any comment or question? If you do, please raise your hand, and we'll deal with that. Yes, David.
Between casual speech and, like, say, taking an oath in an official capacity, like, people in the military have to take an oath to sign in the military. The president takes an oath, takes the oath of office, and so on. So there's places where you're officially putting yourself on record as upholding a certain standard or doing certain things, and that's not what Jesus is talking about here. He's talking about your casual, everyday conversation.
Okay, I'm not so sure I would say that he's not talking about official positions. He says, let your yes be yes and your no be no. I would say that applies all the time and would include official positions. But no matter what, whatever he's saying here specifically, whether he's talking about some kind of public official office or not, we can't tell lies. It doesn't matter if we're under oath or not, let our yes be yes and our no be no. Good point, though. And I bring it up. Now, maybe not everybody agrees with what I said, that Paul took an oath so I can. I'm not here to jump up and down on you and say you have to. But if somebody else does, then be careful how you interact with them and say, hey, you can't do that. Jesus said don't take oaths. If somebody goes and has to testify at court or something like that, or joins the military, something like that. Be careful how you interact with them. Okay. Matthew chapter 5, keep on going here, verse 38. You have heard it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Let us turn to Deuteronomy 19. Deuteronomy 19, so we can understand more of the background of this law. Why was this law given? We have a perfect illustration of why this law was given in Simeon and Levi. Do you remember what Simeon and Levi did? We just studied this. The guy forced their sister, and so they in turn killed everybody in the town and then took everything the town had to offer. Well, that's going beyond justice to vengeance. Okay, chapter 19, Deuteronomy 19:15. A single witness shall not rise up against a man on account of any iniquity or sin, which he has committed. On the evidence of two or three witnesses, a matter shall be confirmed. Stop for a minute. Does this sound like due process or chaos? Everybody, each to their own, go and get what you can. What does it sound like? Right. So whenever somebody's saying the Old Testament, eye for an eye and tooth for a tooth, they're not understanding what God meant. God meant it as a limiting factor. Don't do more, okay? And not only don't do more, but put it before due process. If a malicious witness rises up against a man to accuse him of wrongdoing, both the men who have the dispute shall be stand before the Lord, before the priests and the judges. You see, this is not just everybody for themselves. Well, verse 19. You shall do to him just as he intended to do to his brother. Thus you shall purge evil from among you. The rest will hear and be afraid and will never again do such an evil among you. Thus you shall not show pity, life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. This is saying, you be sure to execute justice, but if you take the whole context in, no more than what is just. The Pharisees lifted this and said, hey, this is not exactly a limiting law, but it gives us the right to execute justice. And I'm going to get my justice every time. Look in Matthew 5. You've heard it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for tooth. But I say to you, do not resist an evil person, but whoever slaps you on your right cheek, turn the other cheek to him also. That is probably an insult. Somebody comes up to you and slaps you on the cheek. It's more of an insult than a punch, although it would apply. The Jew would in turn insult right back. In fact, 1 Peter 3:9 says this, do not return evil for evil, insult for insult. Okay, he's the inspired commentary on this. Verse 40, if anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, let him have your coat also, where the Jew, the Pharisee, would just turn around and sue, I'm going to get him, I'm going to get him for all he's worth. Whoever forces you to go 1 mile, go with him too. The Jew would resist all the way. Give to him who asks of you, and do not turn away from him who wants to borrow from you. Do you remember the parable of the diner, the diners, the guests? Jesus was witnessing at a feast. Everybody was taking the front seats, the good seats. And Jesus said to them, don't take the good seats, wait till you're called up. And then he also says to them, what does he say? Don't have a meal, don't invite people just to the meal, just so you will be invited back. This is an illustration of what's going on here. So, he gives them the true standard. Do not resist an evil person. Whoever slaps you on your right cheek, allow him to insult you twice, is the idea. It's better to allow him to insult you twice than to retaliate in evil. If you've got a choice, and you do, you can retaliate in evil or let him insult you twice. Take the two times insult. If anyone wants to sue you, take your shirt. Let him have your coat also. Whoever forces you to go 1 mile, go with him too. Back then, you remember when Jesus was on the way to be crucified, they had somebody take a cross. The Romans had the authority to do that. You, carry my whatever it is. And so he said, look, go with him 2 miles. Give to him asks of you, and do not turn away from him who wants to borrow. The idea is don't retaliate, but instead do something good for them. Let's keep going just for a minute. Finish up this section. You have heard it said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. And this is where you really see what's been going on all along. The perverted interpretation of the Pharisees. Nowhere in the Old Testament does it say or even hint, hate your enemy. But yet they had gotten out of the Old Testament. It's not like they would say, oh, it's not in there. They would go, they'd try to prove it from the Old Testament. But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. Instead of constantly ill-wishing on them, oh, that, you know what he did to me? I wish. Instead of that, this person, this godly person, is praying for the one. We're not to injure them in return. We're not to keep aloof from them either. But in fact, we're supposed to be doing good for them. Somebody wrote, some persons never have had a particular place in my prayers, but for the injuries that they have done to me. In other words, this person here, he doesn't always pray for Joe over here, except for the fact that Joe did him wrong at one time. And you know what this person's response was? To pray for them in return. We'll go on a minute just to finish up this section. I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. And the rest of it is about partial or being impartial. So that you may be sons of your Father who is in heaven. How sons? For he causes his Son, S-U-N, to rise on the evil and the good. You see, he's impartial. Just like the sun goes across the whole globe and applies and hits everybody, our love should go across everybody that we encounter. For if you love those who love you, and reward, what reward do you have? Do not even the tax collectors do the same? If you greet only your brothers, what more are you doing than others? Do not even the Gentiles do the same? In other words, you're mixed in there with bad company. Finally, somebody wrote, there will certainly be no member of the human race that our love is not due. You find somebody in the human race, and do you know what your obligation to that person is? Doesn't matter who it is, go find somebody, any given person. Our obligation is to love them in a positive way. Therefore, you are to be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. No less love is required of us than God demonstrated for us, is the idea. Now, he has gone from verse 21 to 48. He has gone, he's talking about love the whole time. He has gone from the most obvious and stated negatively, don't murder, don't hate, don't do whatever. And he's gone all the way to still talking about love, stating what is positive about love. Not only should you not murder, but you should love your enemy. So he's gone, he's covered the whole gamut here. And let me say this, at the very end of it, there's no room left for self, is there? We run into somebody, guess what? Our obligation is to put that person higher than we are ourselves. God help us. We have a lot of work to do. And we can do it. You know how I know we can do it? How do you know that we can do this? Because he said it. And he will not require anything of us that we can't do. Comments or questions? I've spoken a lot right there. Gary.
I think this section right here, at least the last part of it, 38, 48, Paul gives a good commentary on that.
Go ahead.
I don't know how far you want me to read.
Oh, whatever you want.
Mm-hmm. Regard for good things beside all men. If it is possible, as much as depends on you, the peace of all men. Beloved, do not avenge yourselves, but rather give place to wrath. For it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. Therefore, if any hungers, feed him. If he thirsts, give him a drink. For in so doing, you will heap coals of fire on his head. You will not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good.
Right.
That's pretty good commentary on.
In fact, yeah, I think it explains that section. Don't be overcome with evil, but overcome evil with good. Don't return, it began by saying never pay back evil for evil. And I think that's his point here. In fact, let me go on with this a little. Anybody else, a comment or question? Let me say this. Here's the question. How broad does Jesus intend the application? And let me be specific. What I'm talking about here is he only talking about in our private lives, one-to-one personal relationships, or a distinction that David brought up a minute ago, is he talking about when we are in some kind of public life? Does it also pertain to that too? And specifically, I'm talking about being in the military. How does this apply differently there? And I don't claim to have the exact answer, okay? All right? But let me suggest to you that things... I think I know. But I also know that there are some who probably disagree with me. Okay? And I want to say, I can understand how there's some fogginess in this area. And again, my whole point here is to be careful how we interact with each other in this. All right? Turn with me for a moment to 2 Thessalonians. 2 Thessalonians, verse 10. 3. Thank you. 2 Thessalonians 3, verse 10. If anyone is not willing to work, then he is not to eat either. Yeah?
So you could make a pretty good application for this, for him who asked him.
And what's the application?
So you're going to give to him who won't work, refuses to work?
Exactly.
You've got to make application.
Right. So the point is, to be clear, just in case you didn't hear that, Gary's making the point, which is excellent. 2 Thessalonians says, look, you've got to work. But Matthew 5 says, you've got to give to those who ask you. So if somebody who's not working comes up to you and asks you to give them something, do you give it to them? No. Because Paul says, if they're not working, and the idea is that they can get a job, they're lazy. That's the idea. It's not that they're disabled or something like that. They can get a job. They just don't want to get a job. And they come up to you and say, hey, can I have some food? Do we give it to them? No, because they're not working. So here's the point. In Matthew chapter 5, we see that he is not always talking about absolutes here. All right, let me state it this way. As in telling them to give to others, he did not mean unconditionally. So in telling them not to resist an evil person, he is not telling them never do anything to restrain an evil person. What can we do? I'll tell you one thing. First of all, let me get this out just in case you didn't think of that. Matthew 18. If somebody's doing evil, can we do something to restrain them? In Matthew 18, it's not physical, but what are we doing? We're coming up to them saying, look, here's the law of God. That is a passive way of trying to restrain. Gary, you want to say something?
Yeah, Paul used that, your second point there. I mean, he appealed to the Roman authorities.
Right.
As a Roman citizen.
Right.
So, I mean, he appealed to the power that was allotted to him by God through the government to keep him from
being people. Right. Turn, in fact, to Romans 13. We were just there. Romans 13, verse 1, every person is to be in subjection to the governing authorities. Because governing authorities are from God. Okay? That's the point he's making. Verse 4, if you do what is evil, be afraid, for it does not bear the sword for nothing. The government does not bear the sword for nothing. What do you use a sword for? Chopping people's heads off or running them through. The idea, it's a picture of capital punishment. Okay? For nothing. For it is a minister of God, an avenger of, who brings wrath on the one who practices evil. Okay, here's the question. Not only does this, running somebody through with a sword, not fit an absolute interpretation of Matthew 5, but here's the other question. The one who did evil, how was he caught? Did somebody come up to him and say, you need to stop what you're doing and come with me? No. They had to get in their police car, drive down the road with the lights flashing, corner on them, run across 5 gates, and then tackle to the ground with 6 people. So, again, the point is not never to do anything. The point is do not return evil for evil. In fact, Exodus 22. Let's turn there very quickly. Exodus 22 speaks about defending your property. Now, this is the old law, and this specific law does not apply to us now, but the general principle says self-defense is not necessarily against the love of God. That's what I'm trying to say. Verse 2, if the thief is caught while breaking in and is struck so that he dies, there will be no blood guiltiness on his account. The thief breaks in. By the way, it's nighttime. Verse 3, if the sun has risen on him, there will be blood guiltiness on his account. So in other words, this assumes if they're running in at nighttime, you don't know what's going on. You go to defend yourself and he dies. You're innocent. Well, if you're innocent in defending yourself, then it's okay. It doesn't necessarily go against the love of God. That's my point here. That's all my point is Jesus is not saying, don't ever do anything. And there are some things that we see we can do. He is telling them never repay evil with evil, which is what we see here. And on top of that, remember this, in self-defense or anything else, our job is not necessarily to defend ourselves, but to do whatever we can in love to help them. whatever that might be required. And I'm not here to judge every given situation. I couldn't. I'm a person. Comments or questions?
Even if justice demands the life of that person, you may still love him by telling him of God.
Yep.
What he must do to save, because he may be required to give his life for what he has done.
You're right.
But you may still love him.
Yeah. People say, oh, and this is very common over in Europe. I ran into this all the time in Europe. Maybe Matt did too. He was there for several years. People say, but the sanctity of life. You people in the United States, you have the capital punishment. But the sanctity of life. But what should be in brackets there is innocent life. Because once you've done something against God's will, and that doesn't mean every little thing, when can God, if you'll pardon the expression, zap us dead? Anytime he wants. The same thing with the government. Once you have done something against the law, you have voluntarily given up your life. And so justice can be executed. And as you say, especially here in the States, as those of us who do use those states that do use the capital punishment, how prolonged an event is it? They've got a long time to accept God, don't they? Other comments or questions here? Okay. Let's rattle through the questions for this today's text. Matthew 6 is where we should be. Matthew 6, let's see. Ethan, please, what is assumed implied within the warning that we will do or that we do? That we are to do.
We must practice righteousness.
Practice our righteousness. Very good. Glad that was understandable. What is the point of instruction? The location, the motivation, or both? Be prepared to support your answer. Jonathan?
This didn't make much sense to me the way you worded it.
Okay.
I got what you meant. And I have the motivation is what he's going for, because after everything he says, to be so that, and is giving a reason for why what he just said, and all of those have to do with motivation.
Okay, motivation, exactly. Everything had to do with motivation. We'll talk more about this in a little while. Sorry that was confusing. I'm glad you eventually got it. Who wants the bonus question? John?
Purpose matters.
What are the consequences of improperly motivated worship? Gary.
You have no reward for God.
Yeah. What is the first example given of practicing righteousness? Jim, please.
Do not sound your trumpet when doing good.
Okay. Giving to the poor. Why do some give? Florence?
That they may be honored.
By men, yes. Those who give that way, what do they have? John Moore.
Have the reward.
How should we give, and what will be the result? Jennifer? Sorry. In secret, and you'll be rewarded in secret also. What is the second example of practicing righteousness? Where are we? Ryan?
Praying properly.
Okay. And how do some pray, and what do they have? Go ahead, Ryan.
In a way to be seen by men and further rewarded in men.
How should we pray, Marcy? And how should we not pray, and why not, Marcy? Okay. What is the third example of practicing righteousness, Jonathan?
Fasting.
How do some people fast, and what will the result be, Jacob?
They fast,
looking pathetic. How should we fast, Ethan?
In secret.
The last question, outline the prayer on the back and be sure to include applications you think of. Let's hold off on that just for a minute, because this is where you get, this is your teach section. You lead, I should say. We're always all teaching each other. All right, Matthew 6. He transitions from talking about their ethics, the poor ethics of the Pharisees, to talking about their poor practices in religion. Beware, this is, you go into Walmart, you see the cuidado sign, the yellow sign that is on the wet floor, says be careful, the road, you know, the curve, be warning, slow down, of practicing your righteousness before men. Righteousness here so far is something you do is what we're talking about. Righteousness can be something you are, a quality. Here it is a behavior. Giving to the poor, praying and fasting are three examples of it. Before men, to be noticed by them. Otherwise, you have no reward with your Father who is in heaven. It's vain effort. It's like putting money into a savings account just to watch the savings account never grow. In fact, losing money. You want to say something?
Well, when we were studying this, the idea of arts, the King James, New King James uses the word charitable deed. Yours uses righteous acts.
I'm sorry, what does yours say?
Charitable deeds.
Oh, yeah.
We kind of got looking that word up, and I was just wondering why such a difference. I understand the idea of the two, but why they translate it so differently in different translations?
Yeah. That caught my eye. I looked it up and I completely forgot. Sorry. I'll get back to that though. Or you can, if you'd like, next week. Ha ha ha. Okay. All right. So let's just be sure to notice something here. We've hinted at this already. Before them to be noticed by them. Actually, before men to be noticed by them, but that's okay. Consider the instructions on prayer. What is the instructions on prayer? When you pray, don't be like the hypocrites. They love to stand in the pray in the synagogues, street corners, so that they may be seen by men. They have their reward in full. Verse 6, you, when you pray, go into your inner room, close your door, and pray to your Father who is in secret, and your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you. Where, according to this instruction, where are we to pray? In a room with the door closed. However, can you think of an example in the New Testament where somebody did not pray in a room with a door closed? Jesus in front of 5,000 people. That's like the extreme opposite of what he's talking about here. Paul prays in Acts 27 in front of the crew on a ship. In 1 Corinthians 14, when you are assembled, we are all to pray together. Does that mean each of us, whoever's praying, runs in the closet? No. The point is that when he says, go and pray to your Father who is in secret, close your door, he's not being literal. And the contrasting location emphasizes the contrasting motivation. Okay? Remember it said, they are praying, verse 1 says, they're practicing the righteousness before men to be noticed by them. First of all, purpose matters. We've seen that, and we're seeing it right here. To be noticed by them, that's their issue. Contrasting locations represent contrasting motivations. The problem isn't wrong location, but wrong motivation. Does that make sense? So here's the application. Verse 2, when you give to the poor, do not sound the trumpet before you as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets, so that they may be honored by men. Truly I say to you, they have their reward in full. When you give to the poor, do not let your right hand know what your left hand know what your right hand is doing, so that your giving will be in secret, and your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you. Is that saying this giving which is done in secret? Remember, the praying is done in secret, but it didn't really mean in secret. The giving which is to be done in secret is not necessarily to be done in secret. We are to let our lights shine. The woman who gave how many? How do we know? They were watching. Now, is she condemned for, number one, giving in public, and number two, letting others somehow know how much she gave? She's praised for having given little, okay? So the point is this. We talk about, I'm not going to give a check into the contribution because somebody else might find out what I know. Okay, but it's not necessarily a sin. That's the whole point here. You're not sinning if you put a check into the contribution or if you go out. What this word trumpet here, the Talmud calls, in some cases, the collection boxes at the temple trumpets because they were shaped like trumpets. So there might be a pun going on here, or obviously the idea behind a trumpet is blowing your horn, tooting your own horn? This is probably what he's referring to. Water cost money back then. So what the Pharisees and the rich people would do is they would go into the middle of the square to the water seller, and they'd say, "Water seller, I'm going to provide some money for you to give water to the poor." And so the water seller, provider, he would call out, "Water for the poor, water for the poor." And they'd all come and get it. You know who was standing right next to him the whole time? The Pharisee. Sometimes we go to charitable events, and when you enter the charitable event, what is posted outside the door? Everybody who gave to the charitable event. And the idea is, look at me, how wonderful I am. Look at this person, how wonderful they are. Here we have contrasting locations or blowing your trumpet. Don't do it to be seen by men. When you give to the poor, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing. Otherwise, you know what your right hand will do? Pat yourself on the back. And that's the general idea going on here. It's going to say, it's impossible for that. This emphasizes that he's not being absolute here. It's impossible for these, they don't think. But in the idea, if the one did think, he'd raise his hand and say, "I did it," or he'd pat himself on the back. Comment or question on this, what we have seen so far? Oh, Matt.
Hi, I'm Matt. Parsons Brother. There's two ways this can go off the rails. I'll just use prayer as an example. Let's say you have a guy who knows it's his turn to lead prayer in the assembly, some places that's assigned beforehand. And so what he does is he gets his dictionary. And he writes down the most flowery prayer he could possibly come up with. Because he knows if he does that, everybody will be very impressed. That's the wrong attitude. But there is corollary to that. You go up the road the other way and think, "Well, I don't want people to think I'm trying to get attention, so I'm not going to try to pray." So I have my three or four key phrases that I'll put in there, and that'll be good enough. Because I wouldn't want people to think I'm just trying to get attention. Both are wrong in this application.
Mm-hmm. I was at a church somewhere once, and the man stood up to pray and essentially shouted to begin the prayer, "Abba, Father, Father." Nothing wrong with that in and of itself. However, as soon as he sat down, the next person got up and said, "I always love it when that guy prays." Nothing wrong in that of itself either. But it's just so dangerous. And Matt brings out a good point. We can do things either way. Just pray. Just pray. That's the idea. Okay, sorry. Somebody else had a point somewhere back here. Okay. Ah, thank you. Yeah, I need that. Especially because he'll be with us for a week and I'll have to, you know. Okay. So, verse 5, "When you pray, you are not to be like the hypocrites, for they love to stand and pray in the synagogues and on the street corners, so that they might be seen by men." In the synagogues, there were certain times that they would pray. And when it came that time to pray, do you know where the Pharisee would find himself? On the entrance, the raised entrance, like this, to the synagogue. Oh, he just happened to be there when it was time to pray, and look at him pray. That's what this is referring to, so that they may be seen by men. "Truly I say to you, they have their reward in full." Their reward in full is men will see them and say, "Ooh, isn't he great?" And that's all they're going to get. They're not going to get anything from God the Father. "But when you pray, go into your inner room, close your door, pray to your Father who is in secret, and to your Father who is in who sees what is done in secret will reward you. And when you are praying, do not use meaningless repetition as the Gentiles do, for they suppose that they will be heard by their many words." Is there anything wrong with being repetitive in your prayer? Depends.
Well, there's the parable of the persistent widow.
And even including, in addition to the parable of the persistent widow, who prayed the same thing three times? Jesus himself prayed the same thing three times. So this is not talking about repetition, but meaningless repetition is what my version says. Somebody read something else earlier.
Vain,
yeah, same idea. The Gentiles. The Gentiles have gods that, number two.
They have two gods.
Yeah. The Gentiles had gods that did two things. Number one, those gods did not care about men. Number two, those gods had better things to do. And so the only way to get the God's attention was to sit there and pound on his door and just wear him down, much like the parable, but in their case, the God didn't even care, much like the parable. Yes, exactly. The over and over, excellent illustration of that. Over and over and over. Louder and louder, cutting themselves. And Jesus is saying, look, don't do that. God knows what you need before you ask him. So in verse 5, 6, we had don't pray to impress God or people. And in verse 8, we have don't pray to inform God. You're not informing God. He knows what you need. Some people ask, well, then why in the world are you praying? If he knows what you need, why do you pray? Luke 18 is an excellent place to turn to. It demonstrates faith. God knows what you need, but what can God not do without your permission? He can't give you what you need. If you don't open up your heart to him and say, God, please come into my life, do for me what I need you to do for me. If you never say that to him, he can't do it. Prayer is the way that we do that. We get down on our knees, we open up our hearts to God and say, God, you know me better than I do. Give it to me, please. Come, David.
I've actually seen this brought up by people who are not believers. And they'll refer to this verse and they'll say, what about, like, say, athletes? Football players, we see them praying on the sidelines, we see them kneeling after touchdowns. What's the, you know, how would you talk about dividing the line between being a good example as someone who is willing to pray regardless of the circumstances and being someone who is seen to be showing off by praying in such a public fashion? So often?
Yeah, a valid point. Gary wanted to say something. Then we need to wrap it up for today.
Just the idea of constant communication with our Father in heaven. Pray without ceasing. I mean, you can be walking to get the cows in the morning. There's nobody around. Pray.
Yep. Yep.
And that's the idea.
Nehemiah. He prayed everywhere he was. He didn't stop praying. You said constant communication. I am reminded the illustration, a valid illustration, is communication between a husband and a wife. If you're not communicating, you know what happens. If you're not communicating with God, likewise, things will happen. Bad things will happen. Go ahead.
Just one example that I've always understood as the vain repetitions or empty phrases. As mine says, is like the Catholics.
Yep.
All their things that they recite, but a lot, I'm pretty sure that a lot of them don't know exactly what they're saying or why they're saying it. So you have to be really careful.
Yeah, and why not say only three Hail Marys instead of four or five? We're going to stop here, but we're going to pick up next week with this last question, outline the prayer on the back, and bring some applications. And so I'll open it up basically next week with you guys sharing those thoughts. Thank you for your sharing today. Yeah, let's start at five after. You know, we should make that up. You should bring that up at the business meeting. That way I'm not bringing it up. Like, general rule. That way I can...
That way you can keep going.
That's right. No. No. And by the way, it wasn't me that kept going today. I was willing to stop 4 minutes ago. You kept on going.
Yeah, but you talked the last minute to let us come in.
Sorry, yeah.
So careful.
Yeah.